muchas personas en el país y que no, claro que es perfectible y que claro que lo podemos mejorar.
We are worried if our country is going to end up like Venezuela.
México libre.
La propuesta de reforma electoral que está proponiendo el partido Morena, que quiere destrozar a la democracia mexicana.
Well, more than 100,000 people demonstrated in Mexico City on Sunday. They were protesting an overhaul of Mexican election laws that critics say would cripple the country's election watchdog. Really, the only body ensuring democracy in a country governed by one-party rule for decades during the 20th century. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador pushed those reforms, saying they are a way to cut costs and rein in an inefficient bureaucracy. And he called the protesters pickpockets and white-collar criminals.
¿Que hay más democracia actualmente en México que en Estados Unidos?
Okay. López Obrador, who is known by his initials as AMLO, insists his country is even more democratic than the United States. That's what he was saying there. My next guest says democracy is under assault in Mexico, and that assault is being led by the Mexican president himself. David Frum is a staff writer for The Atlantic and recently traveled to Mexico City to report out a big news story headlined "The Autocrat Next Door." Welcome back to Press Play, David.
Thank you so much.
Well, you spent a lot of time there in Mexico speaking with lots of people, including election officials. And you wrote this piece, and it was published before these big protests, which not only took place in Mexico City, but across the country in some 100 cities, as I understand it. Are you surprised by the level of anger in the country against these reforms, quote unquote, that the president wants to push through?
I'm hugely encouraged by the level of commitment. A little context here. I worked in the George W. Bush White House. In September of 2001, President Bush welcomed President Vicente Fox for a state visit and was part of the crowd on the South Lawn to receive him. Now, when Vicente Fox came to Washington in 2001, he was the first person in the history, the nearly 200-year, at that point, history of the Mexican Republic, to have come into executive power by means of a free and fair election that peacefully transferred power from one party to another. It had never happened before. And so we're talking here about a 20-year accomplishment. And that's what's now at stake. This is not about election rules. It's not about electoral watchdogs. It's a question of Mexico broke with a highly authoritarian past to create free and fair elections overseen by one of the most important, admired, independent election agencies in the world. And that's what's now at stake.
Well, let's just explain, if people aren't really aware, what this election system known as the National Electoral Institute, or INE, does and why it's so important.
Well, the head of the commission that oversees it said to me, most democratic systems are based on trust. And that's why it's expensive, because it runs a lot of the things that the Federal Election Commission, of course, in the United States, would, or any body like that, would never run. For example, Mexico had a long history of the party of the president controlling how voter registration was done. Well, it happened that people who were known to oppose the president wouldn't get registered, and people who did support him never died. They kept voting decades after their death. So the new body runs the electoral registration system. It issues the ID card that Mexicans use not only to vote, but to get onto an airplane, to open a bank account. This is the most fundamental form of ID. And so when people tell you the system is expensive, well, it's the equivalent of running every driver's license in the country, running every voter registration, all to prevent abuses that happened as recently as the 1980s and 90s.
Okay, so why does AMLO want to undercut it? I guess he wants to starve it of resources, which would make it largely ineffective. Why does he want to do that?
Well, there's one thing to understand. He's kind of a petty person, as that horrible language you quote. I mean, the idea you call peaceful protesters criminals and thieves, and he says worse about anyone who gets in his way. So he ran for president in 2006, and he lost narrowly. Very close election, but one that was overseen by the predecessor of the present Electoral Commission. He believes he was cheated of his due. There's no evidence for, but he believes that, and he blames the Electoral Commission for that defeat. And so he's been spoiling for a long time to get revenge. But he's also trying to consolidate personal power in a way that's quite new and sinister. And he wants to handpick his successor, He's chosen a candidate, by most accounts, who isn't that popular. And so he needs to jerry-rig the electoral system to ensure that he will have the successor he wants.
Right, because he can't run again. Mexican presidents are limited to 1 6-year term. So this presidential election next year, he's not eligible.
I think that, I mean, the taboo against re-election in Mexico is, as I'm sure listeners know, extremely strong. But I don't think it's not crossed his mind that he might be the man to test the taboo. And even if the taboo holds, to extend his power beyond the legal boundaries of his term by having a handpicked successor, against whom, by the way, he's put a lot of weapons to make sure that he'll have a lot of power over that successor. And if he has a weak successor and he has a strong grip on his own party, he could threaten a successor with a recall election. He's also empowered the army in all kinds of very disturbing and quite corrupt ways, and tried to build a personal power base within the army. But one more point, and this is the thing that really for Americans really to worry about. López Obrador is a very strong president trying to get stronger. Mexico is a weak and fragile state. And the thing to worry about is that he will break the Mexican government, enable more violence and more chaos.
Well, violence and chaos has not been a stranger to Mexico even before AMLO. The drug cartels were very powerful even before he ascended to office. So has he dealt with the cartels in his tenure?
Yeah, well, we should not call them drug cartels anymore because they're criminal syndicates. Drugs are one of their businesses. Stealing oil from the national oil monopoly, stealing electricity, human trafficking. But most sinister, the big sources of revenue for them is they function in much of Mexico as an alternative government. So if you own a shop, they come and they extract protection money, taxes, and promise you the protection the government itself no longer provides. So there's growing up this whole alternative power system inside Mexico that contests big parts of the national territory with the national government. And López Obrador campaigned on the slogan of hugs, not bullets. He's tried to draw back from some of the more violent contestation with the criminal cartels. But he's also made a kind of pact with them. And one of the things that was really disturbing was in the elections of 2021, midterm, so Congress is up for contest and about half the state governorships, there was unprecedented levels of violence against politicians and candidates. But the criminals seemed to target the opposition much more than it targeted candidates of López Obrador's Morena party. That's not to say that they were in cahoots or anything like that, but there was a kind of understanding that if you go after the opposition people, the consequences will be a lot less severe for the criminals than if you go after López Obrador's people.
Right. And wasn't there a high-level official who was arrested at LAX recently? And López Obrador basically said, we won't cooperate anymore in terms of cracking down on drug smuggling if you don't return this man to Mexico and drop the charges.
This was a former defense minister. Now, this guy was not particularly close to López Obrador, but it was a signal to López Obrador to the rest of the Mexican military, I've got your back. López Obrador has put the Mexican military in charge of all kinds of economic functions that have never happened before, and you can only imagine the economic opportunities that creates. The United States has always tried to press Mexico to professionalize its military, to insulate them from opportunities for graft. López Obrador is giving them more and more opportunities for graft and showing that he will protect them if the Americans catch them.
Well, speaking of the Americans, what has Joe Biden's response been to this latest move by AMLO to get rid of this elections body or undercut it?
There have been some voices raised inside the Biden administration, which is welcome. There's a limit to the reach of American power here because, of course, it could invite a reaction. The United States has not always been a good neighbor to Mexico, and there's a lot of resentment. But it has to be said that Mexico is one place where the Biden policy has been, unfortunately, very continuous with the Trump policy. Trump wanted a few things for Mexico. He wanted cooperation to suppress the flow of people across the border, and he wanted Mexico to agree to rewrite NAFTA to make it more protectionist against Chinese car parts. So López Obrador gave Trump those two things, and Trump said, fine, I now look the other way as you destroy the Mexican democratic system. Biden has had a somewhat longer wish list of things he wants, but not a lot longer. And he, too, until this past few weeks, has been willing to look away from the structural and constitutional issues in Mexico. Again, there's a limit to what the United States can do. This is a case where people-to-people contact may be more important than anything the U.S. government does. Mexican liberals and Democrats feel very alone. They feel that nobody cares. No one reads the stories in the newspapers about them. And one of the ways You know, one of the things you can do about from Mexico is read about it, care. And if you know people there, let them know. We're with you. We recognize that this, your struggle is connected to struggles we see in places like Hungary, the struggles we see in places like Brazil, struggles we have here right in the United States. Let's not be haughty about this.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I remember when López Obrador was first elected and a lot of these same liberals cheered because he made all of these populist promises to help the underdog, poor people. He comes from a working class background, and that he would attack corruption. So what happened?
What happens is with these authoritarian personalities, it really doesn't matter whether the justifications they offer sound left wing or sound right wing. That you need to, that a López Obrador and a Viktor Orban are not the opposites. They just use different kinds of grievances to mobilize power. So yeah, López Obrador claims to be a man of the left and he attacks his opponents as conservatives. But he doesn't believe in climate change and he's strangling solar power in Mexico to promote fossil fuels. He's rejected the science on COVID and was a COVID denier, was very cagey about whether he himself would ever take the vaccination. He's not very sympathetic to gay rights causes. He's not very sympathetic to feminism. And he doesn't have it at all a democratic ruling style. So if you're thinking left wing, that means like a Danish social democrat, think again. He got along really well with Trump and he gets along really badly with Joe Biden, because he recognized in Trump a fellow spirit, and he doesn't recognize that in Joe Biden.
He actually was singing Trump's praises as recently as a few weeks ago, and we have a clip of tape of him saying that, so let's play it.
Yo estimo mucho al presidente Trump, porque fue respetuoso con nosotros, fue buena la relación. Les puedo decir que fue buena para Estados Unidos, para el pueblo estadounidense, y fue muy buena para el pueblo de México.
Okay, so he says, I hold President Trump in high esteem because he was respectful to us. I can tell you that our relationship was good for the United States, for the American people, and it was good for the people of Mexico. Pretty surprising, but given what you said earlier about what he got from President Trump, I guess I'm not that surprised. What about immigration, though? President Trump railed against Mexico in terms of what was happening at the border and instituted some draconian policies. What is the relationship between the United States and Mexico when it comes to the border right now?
Well, the border is broken. People are flowing across. Some of the Mexican, many others from other places, Central America, even farther afield. You're seeing people from West Africa, from China, who are paying huge sums to be smuggled across the southern border. But here's a way I would encourage people to think about it. I remember the Mexican entry into NAFTA and how exciting that was and how it seemed to offer the possibility for really strong Mexican development, for Mexico to drop its closed state-led economy and have a modern, open, market-led economy that would deliver the growth Mexico needs. If since 1994, the Mexican economy had grown at one-fourth the rate the Chinese economy has grown since 1994, Mexico today would have a standard of living roughly similar to that of France. You don't have mass migration from France to the United States. The United States is a little wealthier than France, but, you know, the French like being French. They have their relatives at home. They have their way of life. They have their language. They don't need, some people move. Some Americans move to France. It's, you don't have this one-way pressure when you have so much poverty against so much wealth. And that failure of development, that failure has been a thing that brought López Obrador to power. But I talk in the article about why NAFTA disappointed. The Mexican elite saw NAFTA as the end of a process of reform, what needed to be the beginning of a process of reform. And so you have these carve-out sections of the Mexican economy that work in a very modern, efficient way. If you visit Monterrey, it looks like very much like a Texan city. But much of the rest of the Mexican economy has been protected from the changes that NAFTA was supposed to bring. And so there's a lot, you have a huge informal economy, which is very inefficient. You still continue to have a lot of very inefficient farms. And Mexico has not caught up, and that's our problem, that Mexico is not the kind of developed country it could have been.
All right, so this plan to weaken the electoral system, the INE, the Supreme Court is looking at it, and is that basically the only bulwark, the only thing standing in between López Obrador's plans to weaken the INE and how it remains today?
Yeah, and it may have some impact. The Mexican Supreme Court, López Obrador, has tried to colonize it. Colonize is the word that they use in Mexico to describe his attempts to infiltrate institutions, and he's had a series of very tricky methods to do that. One of the things he did, this is an example of how you mustn't be fooled by this man. López Obrador, when he took office, took a big salary, and his immediate predecessor had lived in a very flamboyant, way that was off-putting, understandably, to a lot of Mexicans. So Lopez Obrador said, I'm taking this big salary cut. I'm going to live in Republican austerity. I'm going to not move into the presidential palace. I'm going to stay in my apartment. Very noble, right? Except Mexico has a law that the president must be the highest paid official in the country. So when the president cut his own salary, he also cut the salary of every other official at the senior levels of the Mexican civil service. And they're not well paid. So what he drove out anyone who was living on their salary and not by other means, and anyone who had opportunities has been pushed out of the Mexican civil service. And so this had the effect of helping him to colonize various kinds of parts of the bureaucracy. There are parts of the bureaucracy that are supposed to be independent of the president, and he's attacked them. And as with the INE, tried to turn them into political branches that he could control. So the Supreme Court may speak up. He has been less successful colonizing the Supreme Court, but not totally. We hope it will speak up. They are the last chance. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, then you have a question of elections in 2024 that may not be free and may not be fair.
Well, David, thank you. Fascinating story. Thanks for coming on the show to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
David Frum from The Atlantic. You can read his piece there. It's called The Autocrat Next Door, about the Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Coming up, road rage, why bad drivers drive us crazy. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. You may not be surprised to hear road rage incidents are going up in L.A. The news outlet Crosstown crunched the numbers locally and found road rage is the worst it's been in a decade. The worst neighborhood is downtown Los Angeles. And what's more frightening is road rage has become more violent. In 2019, the number of incidents involving a gun was around 100. In 2022, last year, there were more than twice as many. So why is road rage increasing now? Joining us is Ryan Martin, professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, who has studied road rage. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So why do you think incidents of road rage are going up?
Yeah, I think that there are a variety of explanations for this. You know, when people get angry, whether it's behind the wheel or anywhere else, it's usually a confluence of factors. Right? It's something interfering in their goals. It's someone treating them badly, something like that. But it's also exacerbated by stress and anxiety and those sorts of things. And so I think part of what's going on is that Americans are under more stress than they have been. I think there's lingering effects of the pandemic. I think there is economic distress, and those things are giving people a shorter fuse. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of this same sort of anger in other areas. Service providers are saying that they're being treated badly by customers. We're seeing fights at schools and things like that. So this may be a symptom of a broader anger problem we're seeing in America.
Interesting. Also in Los Angeles, and I don't know if it's the same where you are, people are driving faster and just more recklessly.
Yeah, I think there's some evidence that is happening nationally as well. And I also think that exacerbates things. Driving has always been sort of a perfect storm of potentially angering scenarios. But when you add to it additional or increased recklessness from other drivers, increased impatience from drivers, I mean, all of that is going to lead to more and more anger and more aggression.
Can you talk about the psychology behind why other drivers make us so furious? I don't have the same feelings of anger when, let's say, I'm in the supermarket and someone is blocking the aisle with their cart as I do if there's a car or someone acting badly or cuts me off or whatever. I feel blind with rage, and I don't know why. Can you explain it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things going on. One is, and this is going to be similar in the two examples you described, but there's going to be some goal blocking that happens, right? But when you are driving somewhere, you are, you know, pretty much by definition on your way somewhere. So someone interfering in those goals is just inherently frustrating. So that's a big part of it. Another piece, though, is that sort of anxiety that we experience while driving that I think we're oftentimes oblivious to. Driving is inherently dangerous, whether we realize that or not, and we're often a little bit anxious about it. So that recklessness that we see from other drivers means something different to us because it means that person might be putting our lives in danger. They might be putting someone else we care about's life in danger. And so that ends up playing a role as well. But then the third piece is the ability to see the other driver, meaning the actual human being driving the car, which is different from a lot of other settings in that when you can't see the person, you can't identify with them the same way. You don't have a sense for who they are, what kind of person they might be. And that anonymity actually influences how we respond in those situations.
Yeah, I guess it's how people respond in online comments to other people who anger them.
Yeah, that's a very, very similar sort of situation. And that anonymity, or even just maybe it's not anonymous, but that sort of perceived social distance from the person ends up meaning that people say things or do things they wouldn't otherwise do.
Right. It's funny how when somebody does something bad on the road, we always want to see who that driver is. So we'll pass them by and take a look and say, well, who would do such a thing?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a way of trying to get more information about that situation, inform our thinking a little bit about what's going on.
Is there a personality type that's more prone to road rage?
Yeah, I think the research would show that narcissism is probably the most significant personality type that really leads to this. There are going to be some others as well. I think you could say, you know, type A, competitiveness, those sorts of personality factors. But there's been research out there to identify that probably the best predictor are people who are just, whether they actually have full-on, you know, narcissistic personality disorder or just higher on that narcissism scale, that they experience more road rage and are more likely to act aggressively in response to that.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. But we are a nation of narcissists now, so it seems like maybe more of us might be prone to road rage. Not speaking personally or anything.
Yeah, that is a really sort of interesting element here is, you know, as we are seeing that kind of increase, that maybe increases in narcissism are leading to a lot of that increase in road rage.
Okay, so what should we do if we find ourselves on the other end of someone who is raging and we don't want to engage and we don't want to, I don't know, exacerbate the situation? What should we do?
I think you used the key word there, and that is to not engage. I really can't think of anything good that can come from having an interaction, an aggressive interaction on the road. I think by and large, it's very rare that I give sort of never do this advice. But one of the things I would just never do is find ways to tell other drivers how angry I am at them.
Like, don't honk.
Yep. Don't honk. Don't give them the finger. Don't sort of be passive aggressive, sort of slow down in front of them. I think, honestly, the best thing to do is just let them go on their way. It is simply too dangerous an activity to try and, you know, not to make light of it, but to try and play games with people or engage that way. We've seen data, and I've seen data, too, saying that there's an increase in gun use on the road. I just can't imagine there's a good scenario that's going to come from letting someone know how mad you are.
So how do you psychologically handle that? Do you think, oh, that person's having a really, really bad day and try to empathize?
I mean, I think that's one strategy people can use. And I do think it makes sense to, you know, sometimes to reframe those situations. It could be that person's having a bad day. It could be that person is under a lot of stress, who knows? I honestly, for me, a lot of times the answer is I just don't really care. I just know that I want to be further away from them. Very little good is going to come from me engaging. And so it's better to just back off and let them go on their way.
Go on their merry way or their unmarry way.
Yep.
Their angry way. Ryan Martin, a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Thanks again.
Coming up, we continue our series on the Oscar-nominated short documentaries. Today, a man who plans to blow up an Islamic center.
He'd already built the bomb. He was looking for a justification to plant the bomb and commit mass murder. You know, he was hoping to kill 200 people on a Friday night.
Why he did not carry out that plan, the subject of the movie Stranger at the Gate. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In the documentary short, Stranger at the Gate, you meet a man named Mac McKinney. He's a veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who returns home to Muncie, Indiana with PTSD. During his years in the Middle East as a Marine, McKinney's views of Muslims had calcified into rage. One day, after his daughter came home talking about a Muslim friend, he came up with a plan.
My plan was to detonate an IED right outside the Muncie Islamic Center on a Friday afternoon when they were all gathered. And I was hoping for at least 200 or more dead, injured, at least. That was my goal, 200 or more. I knew I'd get caught. Yes, I did this.
But he did not do this. He did not blow up the mosque. Instead, he had what can best be described as a religious conversion. Stranger at the Gate is nominated for an Oscar at this year's Academy Awards for Best Documentary Short Film. And joining me now is the film's director and producer, Joshua Seftel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, it certainly is a dramatic story. Tell us more first about Mac McKinney. What did he do in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Sure. Well, when Mac was serving abroad, in the Marines, he was having trouble dealing with, killing people. And it was hard for him to cope with that. So he went to one of his superiors and he said, I need help. And what they said to him was, look, you need to think of these people as if they're paper targets. You need to think of them as anything but human. And if you can do that, you'll be fine. So that's what he did. And that was, I think, the beginning of what you call it is calcification and this beginning of this sort of dehumanization that he had deep inside him toward Muslims.
So he comes back home and he has a wife and he has a young daughter. And there is this mosque, this Islamic center in town. And this is post 9/11. And one day his daughter comes home from school talking about a kid in class who's Muslim. And what is his reaction to that?
Well, he freaks out. He says, what are you doing playing with Muslim kid? He's a future terrorist. And, he says, I don't want you playing with that kid. And his daughter looked at him and was like, what's wrong? She was 8 years old and she looked him in the eye and said, are you crazy? Like, what's wrong with you, Dad? And he had this sort of moment where he said to himself, I'm going to go to the Islamic Center and I'm going to do some recon and I'm going to prove to her that these people are evil and that I need to blow them up. So that was what set him in motion. This little 8-year-old kind of calling him on things set him into motion to go actually visit the center and ultimately come face to face with the people that he wanted to murder.
So he was intent on finding evildoers, if you will, at the mosque.
Yeah, he was looking for proof. He was looking for a justification. He'd already built the bomb. He was looking for a justification to plant the bomb and commit mass murder. He was hoping to kill 200 people on a Friday night. So he was searching for that.
So had he been making plans before his daughter told him about her Muslim friend?
Yeah, so he had already built the bomb at that point, and he had been making plans for a while. And when his daughter confronted him and they had this argument. First, he went into his bedroom and he was crying because he was just sort of falling apart. He was so upset about all this stuff. And that's when he said to himself, I need to go to the Islamic Center. I need to check it out for myself. I need to get that proof before I blow it up.
So you also tell the story of some of the members of the Islamic Center, including Bibi Bahrami. And she's a refugee from Afghanistan. She came way before. She came in 1986. How did she and her husband decide to settle in Muncie, Indiana, of all places?
Well, so Sabra Bahrami is a physician in Muncie. And so he had an opportunity and a job there. And so the whole family moved there and they started a life there. And, you know, Bibi talks about Muncie. She calls it beautiful Muncie. And Bibi is famous in Muncie. You know, she's an Afghan refugee. She wears hijab. She's just a really important part of the community and a bridge builder. You know, if you walk around Muncie and you mention her name, everyone knows who she is. In fact, her son calls her the Mother Teresa of the Muslim community of Muncie, because she's so generous and she's always having people over at her house and taking care of them and washing their clothes and feeding them. And even when we were filming in Muncie, my crew, Bibi fed us the whole time and was always having us over and giving us food and taking care of us.
Oh, wow. And so when they moved there initially, they were received with open arms in the 80s?
Yeah, they came to Muncie in 86, I believe. And that was, they were welcomed and they talked about how people were, you know, really kind to them. And that's part of why they are so giving, is to return that. So when people come to visit them or other refugees come to Muncie, the Bahramis take them in.
But then things changed a bit after 9/11, right?
After 9/11, you know, I think we saw this all over all over our country. The Bahramis and the members of the Islamic Center of Muncie, they started, you know, facing hateful comments. You know, they said people started to see them differently. People would make comments to Bibi like, you know, why are you wearing that towel on your head? Or, you know, why don't you go back to your country? All the things that we've all heard before, but that became normal for them. And, you know, they were a bit fearful.
Yeah, it sounds really scary, actually. Okay, so back to Mac. I don't want to give away the plot because it's really an extraordinary plot twist, but it's fair to say that Bibi was the main person who averted tragedy that day at the mosque, right? Like, if it weren't for her, things may have gone differently.
Yeah. I mean, Bibi, when Mac showed up at the mosque, Bibi and her husband Sabir were kind to him. I mean, they didn't understand that he was there with bad intentions, that he had a bomb that he was going to use, but they were kind to him. They welcomed the stranger. I mean, they saw this guy and he was scary. I mean, Mac is a big guy. He's got tattoos all over his arms. He's got a skull tattooed into his hand and he was probably wearing a tank top and, you know, just they, you know, and he was nervous and he was red and he was sweaty and they just were like, this guy, there's something wrong with this guy, but they were still open-hearted to him and kind. And they welcomed him in. And in fact, Sabir, Bibi's husband, he hugged his legs. And, you know, he got on his knees and hugged Mac's legs and showed him, sort of welcomed him into the mosque. And, you know, Mac was completely baffled and confused because this is not what he expected. You know, he expected them to be unkind and mean or scary. And instead, they were just met him with kindness and welcomed him in, and he was completely confused.
And there was no one there who was suspicious? I mean, here's this big guy who looks scary, who's obviously not part of the congregation, and he's coming into the mosque. Like, no one is suspicious of that?
The way they described it was, you know, what Bibi said about Mac was, yeah, he was scary and I was a little scared, but I also saw this vulnerability in him and this human side to him that she felt okay about, you know, she felt like, okay, I can get through to this person. And that's what she did. They sat down and she talked with him and asked him questions about his life and, you know, just welcomed him and like a guest, almost like a guest into her home. She sort of showed him that she was interested in him and showed him some compassion.
Of course, it could have gone a lot differently, as we see all the time now in the news that there are angry men with guns who enter places, schools or dance halls or synagogues or what have you, and they unleash a reign of terror. So yes. I guess I'm wondering how you view these events in light of what you learned making this documentary.
I mean, looking around and seeing all these violent acts and these hate crimes that we're seeing constantly now, it's so easy to become hopeless, to feel hopeless. And, you know, the thing that drew me to this story is that it's the story you don't often hear, where there was a hate crime was going to happen, but it was prevented through connection, through kindness, through finding common ground. And it's a beautiful thing when that can happen. And this idea that we have, that we share something, that we all have this shared humanity, and that if we look and we take time, we can find it in each other. I just think that's a message that we all could use right now, because we're in a time where, you know, we don't really talk to each other that much anymore. You know, if a friend votes for a different presidential candidate than we do, we might stop being friends with them these days. You know, like that's the time we live in. And it's, we have to find a way to connect with each other and to remember that we do have this shared humanity between us all. And I think Bibi Barami understood that. And she was able to, through her actions, I think, save lives that day. And, you know, I would just say that I feel like the world could use more Bibi Baramis right now.
But does that put the onus on the victims or on the innocent people, and, you know, to try to prevent some madman from killing them? You know, like how do people know when someone is going to come in and try to do them harm? Like in this case, they didn't have any idea, but you know, oftentimes the victims aren't given any warning. The guy just comes in with guns ablaze.
Yeah, I know. No, I know. I think it's case by case. And I think that this story was one where, you know, he didn't bring the bomb and he didn't bring a gun. And so there was this opportunity and this opportunity to connect. And when they were kind to him, he came back the next day. And when they found out that he had planned to kill them, because they found out later that he had planned to kill them, the first thing Bibi did is she invited him over for dinner. I think there's something really beautiful in that. You know, Bibi Barami is a person who, when she finds out that someone hates her, if she finds out that someone hates Muslims, the first thing she does is invite them over for dinner and try to meet them and try to talk to them. And to me, that's what this film is about, is that idea that we have to find this common ground, and people like Bibi Barami are doing it in a beautiful way, and it's changing the world.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for coming on the show today. It's really a great story.
Thanks. Thanks a lot, Madeline.
That's Joshua Seftel, director and producer of the Oscar-nominated short film Stranger at the Gate, which you can see now on YouTube or at newyorker.com. Coming up, KCRW's Pie Contest is back. Evan Kleinman is here with the details on how you can enter and or partake. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb chop?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes Bake Off Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
And pie, indeed, is what we're going to talk about today. We are going to talk about the KCRW Good Food Pie Contest. It is the original, the OG. It is back this year on April 30th at UCLA. Evan Kleinman is here to discuss. She is the queen of the pie contest. Hello.
Hello. We're back.
We're back. Hallelujah. We took some time off for a pandemic.
Too many years. Too many years.
Exactly.
3 years. Back.
Yeah. Well, it started in 2009, so that's 14 years ago. Long time ago.
It's a long time ago. It's really amazing when you come up with an idea and it has this kind of legs. It's just super gratifying.
It's incredible. How did you come up with this idea?
Well, in 2009, I was kind of looking at the summer ahead of me with no travel planned. And I thought, oh, I need a project. Maybe I'll make a pie a day and blog about it. To which my producer said, well, if you start that, you know you have to do it every single day. So I did. And a pie community ended up coalescing around my failures and successes. So I pitched the idea for this virtual community that had sprung up on social media to come together in real life. So the first one was in November of 2009 at the Westfield Topanga Mall. 400 people came, including the bakers. Mm. We're expecting 4,000 this year.
Oh my gosh, 10 times the amount.
Yeah. Over the years, it's become a complete family festival with activities, which is why this year we're calling it a Pie Fest and Contest.
Pie Fest and Contest, which I like. I like the rhyming. And it has morphed as well from something kind of impromptu into something pretty official. Like there are rules, there are various categories, there are official judges who are real chefs in the world. Tell us more.
We've been really lucky to have a really amazing judging panel made up of, you know, chefs, pastry chefs, bakers, and teachers. This year we have, I think, 31 lined up to judge all the pies. We expect we'll get somewhere around 450 entries. Every judge is assigned a particular category. No judge is responsible for eating all of that pie. It would be impossible. And
yeah, it would be something Roman would be happening.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
But the judges love it. I mean, it's a fantastic gathering for them because they get to yell at each other.
Do they really yell at each other? Does it get that heated?
Oh my gosh, it is so passionate. They take it so seriously. And because we judge via consensus, you know, we don't have a point system that they have to go through. They basically just start talking, the people in their group, in their category, just start talking about the pies that they feel are in the top. And then they start arguing about them till they whittle down to three.
Wow. And what are the categories?
There are 8 categories. Let's see if I can remember them all. There is fruit. There's apple. There is nut, custard, savory, vegan, cream. And each year, because the Fowler Museum at UCLA, which is where this contest takes place, is our partner in the event, we pick an exhibit that is happening at the museum to inspire pie. So this year it's we have a category called lineage pie, which is basically about people telling their own personal story about borders with their pie.
Oh, wow. That sounds incredible. So you can win in your category, but also then there's an overall winner, right, of all the pies?
Yes. Oh, and I should say there's also a children's category.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. And yes, oh my goodness, there's so many ribbons. There is first, second, and third in every category. And then there is a best in show and there is a best crust.
Okay, best crust. Can I just delve into that for a second?
Sure.
Because Do you have particular criteria for your favorite crust, like all butter versus not all butter?
You know, what's really interesting about that particular ribbon is that is usually one of the easiest to give because we all have pretty much the same criteria. You know, it needs to be a beautifully flaky crust. Mm-hmm. It needs to taste good because, you know, yeah. Some crusts are very bland if people don't season them with, you know, a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar, maybe a little bit of vinegar. And they need to be well baked. A lot of bakers underbake their pies.
Yeah, a crust needs to be like a mahogany color, right?
Yeah, it needs to be well caramelized.
For such a few ingredients, it really is complicated.
Because pies have many different parts, you know, you have the vessel, you know, whether it's a lidded pie or it's just a single crust, you have the filling and you have a topping. And you can go wrong in many places along that voyage.
And do all the entrants have to be original recipes?
No, of course not. I mean, people have been making pies for centuries. And I would say that some of the more complex tasting pies aren't the ones that win. Because, you know, the judges are tasting all of these pies. When they hit something that's just a great version of that category, they know immediately.
And anyone can participate, right? You don't have to be an expert or a professional.
Oh, not at all. I mean, how much bad pie have we all eaten in restaurants or even in a bake shop? You know, pros enter each year and they lose to home bakers. It's really just about practice.
So you could conceivably enter a pie in every category?
Yes, you can enter as many pies as you wish, but only one per category.
So if people want to enter, what do they do?
You go to kcrw.com/pie, and all of the information about the festival and entering a pie is there.
Okay, so those are the people who are actually participating and are competing in the pie contest, but what about the people who just want to attend and eat?
Well, like all KCRW events, it's free to the public. You just need to show up, stand in line, get your wristband, and enjoy your day.
Okay, so the winning pie, can you give us a hint? We already talked about the crust. It needs to be flaky and mahogany colored. What about the filling? What makes a winning pie?
You know, that's the part that is just unknowable until the day of the contest. We have no idea. That's part of the excitement for the judges of judging the pies.
Can you remember a recent winner that just blew your mind?
I think that every year pies blow my mind. All of life is a bell curve. There's a little bit of truly awful things, a little bit of truly excellent things, and then there are a lot of things that range in the middle.
True. That is true. Okay, sweet versus savory. I mean, I think most people would favor a sweet pie over a savory pie, but maybe not.
Savory pies have won a couple times, and each one of those pies have been just absolutely delicious. Like, I still remember a savory pie from, I think it was the second pie contest, that was made by a young man from Japan who had been in America for a very short period of time, and he was teaching himself English by watching the Food Network. And he did a pie that was basically, you know, ground beef filling that was so delicious. I think about that pie a lot. Like, it was a type of cottage pie. It was so good.
Oh my gosh. And it just had ground beef in it?
That was sort of the basic
Yeah.
part of it. It was a cottage pie, but it was just so good.
Mm. And of course, it had a great crust. That sounds so delicious right now. You're making me hungry.
I know. I'm like, my mouth is actually watering about that pie.
Well, I'm so excited for the return of the pie contest.
Me too. I can't wait to see how it plays out. You know, it happens in the Royce Quad. So people who have never been to UCLA, it's an absolutely beautiful campus. And it's just the greatest venue for picnicking, listening to music, playing games, checking out a marketplace, and of course, eating a lot of pie.
Evan Kleinman, host of KCRLB's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 10 or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen whenever you want. And the Good Food Pie Contest. It will be on April 30th at UCLA. So, I don't know. Mark your calendars.
And if you're a baker, just go to the website, kcrw.com/pie, and enter.
Yes, please do. I can't wait to taste them myself. All right, Evan Kleinman, the pie queen herself. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. Go eat some pie. I'll see you tomorrow.